A murder mystery in 1968 Dublin, where the detective isn't a policeman, but a young female news reporter on the make.
I loved writing about it, and I particularly enjoyed writing about 1968 because there was none of the technology that we take for granted now. There was no Google search or WhatsApp message to alert Nicoletta to anything that might have been occurring. So all of her knowledge that she accumulated had to be achieved by the old-fashioned way of walking around Dublin talking to people. And I really enjoyed that slower pace, I think, of not the instant gratification we're used to now in terms of information, you know.
That's Claire Coughlin. We talk with her about her twisty-turny whodunit, Where They Lie. But first, we talk with Rue Matheson, daughter of the famed writer Peter Matheson, about her family memoir, Castles and Ruins, Unraveling Family Mysteries and Literary Legacy in the Irish Countryside. And then finally, we air a short clip from our conversation with Fintan O'Toole last St. Patrick's Day about his personal history of modern Ireland, We Don't Know Ourselves. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Decades after spending a summer in the Irish countryside with her parents, author Deborah Love and National Book Award winner Peter Matheson, Rue Matheson took her young family back to Ireland to revisit locales from that season in the 60s. As a guide, she had her mother's book, Anakin, named for the castle that overlooked their home in Galway. In her memoir, Castles and Ruins, Rue Matheson uses her memories of those two journeys to Ireland to dig deeper into her parents' literary legacy, their stormy marriage, and their complicated relationships to their children. The book is also a vivid portrait of the artistic community on the east end of Long Island that flourished in the 1960s and 70s. It's a community I knew well, as my own parents were embedded in it by way of my mother, Frances Olenikoff's career as a choreographer and performance artist. Years later, I became a member of the Zen community that Rue Matheson's mother founded and that her father, Peter, long led until he became too ill to continue as its priest. Rue Matheson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. I'm delighted to be here.
So this book, Castles and Ruins, Unraveling Family Mysteries and Literary Legacy in the Irish Countryside, it centers around the journey to Ireland that you took with your family, first that you took with your family, your mother, Deborah Love, and your father, famed author Peter Matheson, when you were a child in 1965, and then your reprise of that journey accompanied by your mother's book about it, Anakin, and your family, your husband Steve and your son Emmett. So first of all, why did you want to make this second journey? And also, when did you make it? I looked for the date, but I couldn't find it.
Well, I made it in 2006. So it was quite a while ago. My son was 6 years old at the time. And my husband, who's retired now, he was still a teacher in the public school. So he had summers off. And it just kind of occurred to me when Emmett was around the age that I was when I was in Ireland as a child. And I thought, wouldn't it be neat to go back? I hadn't been back one time. So I thought, let's just go. And I married this guy, Shaughnessy, you know. I mean, there was a lot of Ireland in my past, a lot of Ireland in my present. And I thought it would be neat for Steve to go back. Not back. He'd never been there. But all of us to go and just have a long trip and maybe find this castle, which was on the shore of Lough Corrib. And in 1965, we lived in a little house on an island that was across the waterway from the castle. And at that time, I did not have a map. It, you know, it wasn't on Google. Nothing. So I kind of just had the coordinates from my mother's book because she had written down in her sort of poetic, somewhat abstract way, but nonetheless did write down coordinates, you know, make a left here and a right there and so on to get to the house and the castle. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to just go back and look at it? So I started putting together the trip, and then we were off. Steve agreed, and Emmett was small, and it just seemed like a really good idea. I should say, though, that it was one of those funny things. I did not have a book in mind when I went there. I just thought it would be interesting, and I thought it would be interesting to see that place again because it was always very vivid in my memories. And then I had my mother's book called Anakin, which was an account of that summer, also an account of her life and her marriage and her segue into Zen. At that time, she was still pre-Zen Buddhist, but she was getting there. It was very much in her thoughts. I had a little journal that she encouraged me to keep, and she published that journal in her book. So I always had this book as a touchstone. And then I thought, wow, you know, that might be very interesting. So we just went. And it was all such a huge surprise in a way because it was almost as if they were still there. It was just incredible.
And it is so vivid, your account. So you bring the visit so alive, as well as your parents. And I mean, it's a fascinating account. And in 1965, your parents took this journey, hoping that their sojourn in Ireland would save their marriage. Talk about the purposes, or at least your mother hoped that to be true. And I think your father did as well.
Yeah, I think they both were interested in trying to keep it all going. Their marriage was always somewhat rocky and also very transformative for both of them. It was a very intense kind of union. And I think also my father's career was on the cusp of really taking off. And they were really in Sagaponack at the time where we lived, it was just there were, and in the whole area, there were many creatives who were hugely famous or going to be hugely famous. And it was a very social, literary world that they were in that I think they enjoyed. But also, they did not think it was conducive to good work. They were both serious about, they were both ambitious, and they, I think, felt a bit strung out by all the parties. And I will say they were invited to the black and white ball, which everyone is still talking about, and they didn't go.
And
So
that was, explain what that was for our listeners.
black and white ball was given by Katharine Graham at, I don't know the venue, but it was in the city, and it was for Truman Capote. And it was sort of the party that everyone is still talking about. I mean, everybody who was prominent in literary circles, journalism circles, I mean, anybody who was anybody, which is such an awful phrase, but it really was the party of the decade. And they passed. They didn't go. That was kind of where they were turning away to some degree. I think it was a stage on the way to their involvement with Zen Buddhism. And then also my father ended up writing so many books, and he needed the time, he needed the focus, and he found a lot of the stuff going on in New York as his career was taking off to be a distraction. And I think my mother wasn't a hugely social person either. So I think they were looking for a sort of respite. And I've always thought of that summer as like back in the States in 1965, the war was the Gulf of Tonkin. I think that was 65 or 66. The whole country was on the cusp of this revolution and, you know, really getting into the war and, you know, experimentation with psychotropic drugs. But there was a moment for me, of course, I was just 7 years old, but I remember it as a sort of holding of the breath, like an intake of breath before something big was going to happen. And in a way that aligned with this trip we took to this very quiet, beautiful place. And I always remembered Ireland as sort of the last place that we were really intact as a family, where we really had each other. The house was small. My brother Luke, who sadly died last year, he was there. He was 12. Some of the family wasn't there, but it was just us four. And it was, for me, just, you know, from the perspective of a very young person, it was sort of the last respite before we went back to the States and everything seemed to explode. I mean, that's the way I experienced it. So that's why I wanted to write a book about that.
Yes, and much of the book is really taken up with your mother, your relationship with her, her relationship to your father, Peter Matheson. Full disclosure, I'm a member of the Zendo that was founded by your father decades ago and that met until your father's death in 2014 in a small outbuilding on your parents' property in Sagaponack, Long Island in New York. I started going in 2009. And I was there on some few occasions when your father also attended, but it was when he was already quite sick with cancer. And I never felt comfortable in introducing myself to him. I always felt that he was an aloof and unapproachable presence. And I thought it was because of his illness. But in fact, the way you describe Peter Matheson in this book and your father, he was pretty unapproachable in many ways way before that. In fact, you write, his considerable self-containment lent him a tremendous personal power and a charisma, but also a real remoteness in personal relationships. Is that right? And say more about that.
Well, yes, I would say he was remote, but he was guarding his time. He was guarding himself. To a degree, with an output like that, I think you have to. And I did also write that he was surprisingly tuned in to the people in his life, but not consistently tuned in. So I think of most parents and the parent that I try to be, which is like just sort of steady and ordinary and kind of just there and willing to help and listen. That was not him, but for all the remoteness and the travels and the self-focus, and I've talked to my brother about this, he really was a kind of a magical person in the way that he would know where you were in your life. You know, he would sort of tell you where you were, and he would be surprisingly insightful. And so, I mean, he also was very funny. So that was one way that he and I really connected, because we love to laugh at things, and he had a pretty dark sense of humor, and it was like a great, for him, the you know, humor was just this great relief valve, and it's sort of that way for me too. And I don't know, I just think humor and to be able to laugh is a great gift, and I think it's a way with someone like that to be very close. So, yeah, I wouldn't give him the Father of the Year award, but also people loved him so much, and his family loved him. Yeah, we had to put up with them, but we also really loved him and admired him, and in our way, which was not at all a conventional way, got a lot from him. So it's sort of a many-sided sort of thing.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, because while that's in the book, I got a much darker picture of him from this book, Castles and Ruins. You say, for example, he worked assiduously for the environment, which is true, for the rights of indigenous people, but his compassion did not extend to his wife and children. So how do you reconcile those opposites?
Which is the reason I wrote the book, because I wanted that part of myself as a young person that doesn't understand what your parents need. You don't really understand your parents as people, what they need. The main periods of my life were my childhood, you know, around 7 years old, and then my adolescence when my mother died. And it's hard to reconcile it all as a young person. But when I got older, I saw what he did for people, and I saw the joy that he gave people with brilliant writing. And I admired, I just, you know, that was the way I reconciled it, was being able to grow up and say, and to also see why he had this incredible drive to do the things that he did. Was that out of a completely happy place? No, he was extremely complicated. But I had empathy for him. I developed a lot of empathy for him through knowing him as an adult. And I saw what he struggled with. He was a depressive, there's no doubt. And I was able to accept him. But I do sometimes say to people that I sort of had this idea of what men were when I was young. And then I got out into the world, which I did pretty early. And I got to know, you know, my friends, and then also men, guys. And I was like, man, this is a piece of cake. I mean, they all seem so straightforward and comfortable, and they meant what they said, and they did what they said they were going to. I mean, it was all so simple compared to this man that I had grown up with, who was so very complicated and difficult. He was definitely difficult. But that was another reason I wanted to write the book, because I realized that a lot of people don't have a, you know, really high-powered, ambitious, creative parents, and they don't know what it's like. And so I thought maybe it would be interesting to read what that's like.
Well, I've related to it because my mother was an artist and a performance artist, and also completely dedicated to her work. And I came second, but it was second. It wasn't third. So I related to a lot in your book, and I've, of course, appreciated her tremendously for the kind of amazing human being she was, but as a mother, maybe not so much. So now tell us about your mother. First, just as she was, not as a mother, not as a wife, because we'll get into that afterwards.
She was a poetic person, I would say. She was a very good poet. She was a very good writer. She was a very good student. I'm actually working on a biography, or just a straight-ahead biography, possibly. I don't know if it has legs. But she went to the University of Colorado. She had just turned 17. She was quite ambitious, I would say. She was an elegant person. She had a sort of a patrician accent. She never swore that I remember. And she was quite moody. And she was a person also who had terrible eczema as a child. And it was before cortisone drugs were discovered. And she was plagued by this eczema. It was extremely, extremely harrowing experience that I think really damaged her in terms of just being able to sort of be easy with things. She wasn't really easy with things. She was also enormously intelligent and, you know, with a very high conceptual ability, and which sort of plagued her. She couldn't really put like these huge questions to, which is why she became really a philosopher and then led her to Zen, was she had like a deep spiritual need to sort of find comfort and find a place to be philosophically. She had totally angry at the Episcopalian God. She had just had enough of that, and it didn't do anything for her. She was also quite funny, a good sportswoman, and a very good friend to a few people. And she knew a lot of people, but I think that she really was not very open and connected with most people, but had a few trustworthy friends who, fortunately, I knew, and who helped me in my life and who helped me.
And talk now about, well, first your parents' relationship. It really strikes me in this book, Rue Matheson, In Castles and Ruins, how unequal it was. Now, part of that is a reflection of the times. This is the 1960s. This was even before the women's liberation movement. And we know, of course, 50 years later, women are still not equal. But nonetheless, you know, the power seems very much one in which your father had. You talk about his compulsive affairs and how agonizing that was for your mother. Also, the thwarting of her ambitions as an artist. So talk about what part of their relationship is just part of the social milieu, the fact of your father's fame, the position of women, and what part is also just really particular to them?
Well, he was, aside from wanting her to take care of almost all the domestic stuff, which he just was, he was kind of coded that way. Unfortunately, he was very supportive and admiring of her and thought she was a very good writer and looked at her drafts and all of that kind of thing. And I would say, yes, you know, the times, the way the times were then, which was definitely worse, harder to get a foot in the door for a woman, was working against her and holding her back. I think she was pretty disappointed. She had that book published. She had some good reviews, and it's a lovely, lovely book. And then, you know, it just kind of disappeared. And his books, he was cranking out these books, and he was a literary lion. You know, there were these men who were literary lions, and they had great authority and they had great followings. I think that it's very difficult to be in a marriage of twins. She was very ambitious as well, and I think that that was a source of conflict. He had two children from his first marriage. She had me, and, you know, it was complicated, and just all the arrangements and things like that and the travels and so forth. She resented that it fell to her.
You're not his biological child, but he came into your life when you were extremely young.
Yeah, he came into my life when I was 2 years old, and they were living together from then on. And I don't really remember very well my biological father, who also died in 1972. So he died a few months after she died, which was a shame. But I never knew him. I think, though, that there was a kind of an energy between them. They were speaking each other's language. So for all of the stuff in the way that, yeah, she I think, was compromised and held back to a degree, it wasn't that he discounted what she did. She was the first to get into Zen in the family. She started going to Alan Watts lectures. She started reading all the books. And then she started going on sesshins and going up to that place up in the Catskills and sitting regularly. It became, her friends were people who were doing also Japanese tea ceremony, and then segueing into Zen. And he followed her there. She was the first to, he always said, on their first date, when she was living in Bridgehampton, when I was very, very small, she agreed to a first date, but only if he would bring psilocybin. So came up with the psilocybin because he wanted to date her. And I think she was a real inspiration to him. And he was very sensitive to that, I think, in as much as he could be. And I think he certainly said more than once that she was just really finding her voice as a writer when she got sick. But he was very interested in the development of a writer, any writer, like where they started. He was supportive of people who he knew and was close to who were trying to write. And he felt that she was really hitting her stride and that she found great joy in it. And of course, he missed her for many other reasons. But I think he found that that was very sad because she was looking around for something to apply her prodigious intelligence to. And when she found that, she was more balanced and then I think would have gone on to, you know, maybe not had a career like his, but she would have gone on to write many books.
And Rue Matheson, in the book, you say that you've always known that your mother's world and yours was dangerously intertwined. In fact, I think it was, you could say, quite enmeshed in many ways, especially in the absence of your father when he would go off, you know, to his writing studio or to his journeys to do research for his books. And, you know, you were 13 when your mother died, an incredibly sensitive age. You write about being, you know, unmoved by the obvious pain that she was in her last days. And your reaction to her death was, I think you can safely describe it as quite shut down. So talk about that interrelationship that you had with her, your own struggle to be your own person with two parents who were, you know, pretty overwhelming in their kind of bright stars in your firmament.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's when I look back on that period when she was sick, I think there's a kind of a defense system that kicks in when you are too young to be able to understand something. You don't want to understand it, and you don't. I think that you just put it to the side. And the other thing, I think when you lose someone who's young, when you're young, well, she was also young too. She was only 44. So it takes a lifetime to understand how big that loss is. You never actually do completely understand it. I'm sure it's hard to lose a family member at any point in your life when you're older, but I know for a fact, having gone through my father's death in 2014, that he had lived a full life. He and I had become close, I'd say not tremendously close, but we were close enough. It was pretty good. And we were also resolved. And he had had his chance. He had done his things that he wanted to do. And it's different with a young death. You don't understand it. Conceptually, you cannot wrap your mind or your heart around what is happening right in front of you. And I think that it changes you. I think that you never are the same person that you would have been, but you don't have any concept of that at the time because you don't have the maturity. You're just trying to plow through another day, but it affects you very deeply. And you are never the same. I mean, I think maybe some of the drive that I had to write is because her voice was silenced. And then the other thing is you are their relative, and you find that the same things that you love are things that they loved, and you carry it on. And it's very comforting. I mean, I always feel that both of them are with me to some kind of degree when I'm off on some writing adventure. And they're sort of saying, well, you know, take out that sentence. That's not very good. And you know, you could amp up that part.
Well, that's great. And also, how has writing this book, Castles and Ruins, helped you process your mother's death and your relationship to her? Because it is so much of it is really a huge part of this book.
It is, yes. Well, there's something very satisfying when you've said something and you said it the best that you can say it, and it's precise and it's articulate and it's specific to the actual thing that happened. The dynamic between me and her was very specific. I mean, that's what poetry really is, isn't it? I mean, it's just like something that is germane to one particular unique thing or feeling. And when that is expressed and you can look at it on the page and you can say, oh, yes, you know, that's what I meant to say. That's it there. It's kind of alive. My mother's book, Anna Keene, when I looked at Anna Keene, really, when I read it very, very carefully, and then I went back to The Snow Leopard, my father's book, The Snow Leopard, for some things and just, you know, ideas, get a feel of that. And I realized how much Anakin and the Snow Leopard were like twin books. There's a lot that he draws from her approach to her book that he uses to approach his book. And I said to him one time, because he was frustrated with that being his most popular book, because he considered himself a fiction writer, first and foremost. And I said, Dad, the reason that people love it so much is because it's you. Because it's one of the few books where there's no scrims. You know, it's him. It's the struggle. It's having lost his wife. And there's like an honesty there that just resonates with the reader. I didn't go into all that. I just said, it's you. That's why everybody loves it. And he had a little smile about that. But I feel also that my book is now kind of with those two books. And it's a little bit of a triad in the family that gives me great satisfaction because everybody has had their say.
That's lovely. And the book is Castles and Ruins, Unraveling Family Mysteries and Literary Legacy in the Irish Countryside. Rue Matheson, thank you so much for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much. This has been great. And thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Rue Matheson. Next up, more for St. Patrick's Day with a terrific crime fiction debut. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. Former investigative journalist Claire Coughlin always wanted to write crime fiction, and we are so glad she's finally been able to do so. Her debut novel is Where They Lie. It's 1968 Dublin, and Ireland is on the cusp. The stranglehold grip of the old order of the Catholic Church is just beginning to slacken. There are new opportunities for women in investigative journalism, for example. But contraception won't be available until 1985 and abortion until 2018. That's 50 years after Coughlin's protagonist, the young female journalist Nicoletta Sarto, takes on the task of investigating a case long gone cold, the death of a young woman that could be linked to a clandestine abortion clinic. A beautifully atmospheric thriller, Where They Lie uses a murder mystery as a lens to focus on the long struggle of women fighting to achieve autonomy in Ireland's man's world. Claire Coughlin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me, Francesca.
Now, this is just a terrific debut novel, but you are not a newcomer to writing. You've worked as a journalist for the last 18 years, and your protagonist, Nicoletta Sarto, is also a journalist. So tell us a little bit about why you made this jump from journalism, although I assume you haven't left journalism, to mystery writing.
First of all, thank you so much for your kind words about my novel. It was a long time in the making. I think I always wanted to write fiction, but when I left university, I studied English and Italian at University College Dublin, and I always wanted to write fiction, but I didn't know how to go about doing it. So I thought journalism would be a good stepping stone into writing. I didn't really know that much at the time. I just thought I wanted to write, and that was the only feasible way of going about it. I didn't really know anyone who'd become a novelist, although Cecilia Hearn, who's been very successful since a young age, I think she was 21 when her first novel was published, broke the mold for Irish female writers in a commercial sense. But yeah, I was coming at it from a sense of when I had been a journalist for about 5 years, I decided to do an MA in creative writing in UCD. And I then decided that I really wanted to write about a journalist, but I just didn't know when or how.
Well, it's a terrific choice because this is an investigative journalist. I think it's the other profession that's great for being featured in mystery writing. You know, there's detectives.
Yes. But... Yeah. The journalist as detective is something I loved writing about. And I particularly enjoyed writing about 1968 because there was none of the technology that we take for granted now. There was no Google search or WhatsApp message to alert Nicoletta to anything that might have been occurring. So all of her knowledge that she accumulated had to be achieved by the old-fashioned way of walking around Dublin, talking to people. And I really enjoyed that slower pace, I think, of not the instant gratification we're used to now in terms of information, you know.
Yeah, and also you have such vivid descriptions of Ireland at that time. Before we get into the meat of this great story, you know, talk a little bit about the process of bringing 1968 to life.
Okay, well, I went to the National Library in Dublin and read some of the contemporaneous newspapers from the time. I also read a book called Maeve's Times, which was a compendium of journalism by the late novelist Maeve Binchy. And she was actually the first women's pages editor of the Irish Times newspaper. And in her collection of journalism is like her novels. It's fierce, uncompromising, with a great sense of humor. And a lot of the issues she covered are still prescient today, such as abortion rights, contraception, a woman's place in the workplace and in the home. And I knew once I'd read this collection of journalism that I wanted to set my journalist character at a time that was changing, but also at a time that was kind of static in Ireland, because Ireland was still very much, emigration was very high and women's place in society was very defined by a domestic role. And I decided that that's exactly when I wanted to set it.
Yeah. And, you know, I was really thinking a lot about Tana French as I read this novel, Where They Lie. Claire Coughlan, she wrote the blurb that's on the front cover, and she also examines social issues through the medium of mystery fiction. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think essentially all novels have a mystery at their heart, but I just love crime fiction as a medium to make it bigger and better brush strokes, if you want to call it that. And I was so happy when Tana gave me that quote. I mean, I've been a big fan of her since 2007, 2008, when her first novel came out. And I actually interviewed her for an Irish newspaper at the time that her first novel came out. And I've read every single one since. And she was a big inspiration in terms of, I knew I wanted to write about Dublin. And I knew I wanted to examine the social issues behind the themes that I was writing about.
Hmm. Yeah, she's been on the show at least two times, maybe more.
Yeah.
She's great. So now tell us more about the story. We know that it features a journalist and crime.
Yeah.
It takes place when the body of an actress who disappeared 25 years earlier is found. So introduce us to the story. Tell us about the young journalist who investigates that crime and that disappearance, Nicoletta Sarto.
So Nicoletta is in the newsroom on Christmas Eve when a call comes through saying that a woman's skeleton has been found in a seaside garden, and it's been positively identified as Julia Bridges, an actress who disappeared in 1943. And Nicoletta knows that she wants to make, she's young, driven, very ambitious. She's conflicted and she wants to make a name for herself. So she decides to undertake this story and see where it takes her. And it leads her into a kind of web of, she uncovers all the hypocrisies and lies that she's encountered all her life and unravels them. And I suppose you could say the truth comes at a price for Nicoletta. And
yeah, so the story involves an ex-midwife, Gloria Fitzpatrick, who also is not alive when the story begins. She lost her license after performing a botched abortion, And as you mentioned before, this book examines the position of women in Ireland actually from several different angles, discrimination in the workplace and lack of reproductive freedom. And it was only recently, in 2018, that abortion was legalized in Ireland. So talk about what it was like to be a woman in 1968 and before in your country.
Mm-hmm. I think there was a climate of fear. There was a climate of secrecy and a culture of, I suppose, hypocrisy, because everyone knew, yet everyone pretended not to know. And it was very much a woman's problem. If an unwanted pregnancy occurred, contraception was illegal. And up until recently, if you wanted to have an abortion, you had to go to the UK. And there was still very much a culture of secrecy and shame attached to that particular journey.
And what was it like to be a journalist as a woman in that time?
I think it was more difficult than anything that I ever experienced as a journalist. I think the constant need to prove oneself was ever present. And I think there might have been a sense as well that you didn't belong.
Were there many women who were in journalism and still had to fight, or was it beginning to change at that time?
It was definitely beginning to change at that time. And the Irish Women's Liberation Movement was founded in 1970. And that was made up of many women journalists. And they staged a train journey to Belfast to buy condoms and brought them back and were photographed bringing them back over into Connolly Station in Dublin to make a point that it was a woman's choice, like that women deserved reproductive choices. And so times were changing, but I think the particular time I wrote about in 1968, things were kind of on the cusp.
They were on the cusp, and yet it took until 2018 to actually legalize abortion. Of course, in this country, we had reproductive rights for 50 years, and they've just been taken away. So there's no judgment there. But I just wonder, do you have any opinion as to why it took so long?
I think attitudes took a long time to change, and Ireland is a very multicultural, cosmopolitan country now. But it took a while, I suppose, for economic reasons as well. Like they say that the swinging 60s didn't happen in Ireland until the economic boom of the Celtic Tiger, which was the 1990s. You know, like same-sex marriage was legalized in Ireland in 2015 as well. So we have come a long way. But I think it just took that long for the attitudes of especially the church and state were so entwined as well, the Catholic Church.
Yeah. So, and we are talking with Claire Coughlin about her novel, her crime fiction novel, Where They Lie. Now, you know, it struck me that the other reporters at the paper's called The Sentinel, are for the most part supportive of Nicoletta. I was a little surprised at that because I thought, well, there would have been a lot of kind of backbiting or resentment. But no. They're pretty supportive. Do you want to say why you made that choice? And is that what you've experienced?
Yeah, Nicoletta's colleagues are supportive of her for the most part. It's just kind of structural inequalities that stand in her way. Like on paper, her male colleagues don't have much of a problem with her, apart from the fact that she's in a relationship with her boss. But for things like, for example, in the sequel that I'm writing at the moment, she's just returned from maternity leave, but it's a very short maternity leave. And she feels that if she doesn't go back quickly, she'll lose her position.
Well, I can't wait to read that because this was really terrific read. I mean, lots of twisty turns, which I'm going to ask you a little bit about later. But, you know, with a mystery like this one, we really can't give anything away about the plot that would spoil the suspense. But you did mention before that it came at a personal cost. The investigation comes at a personal cost for Nicoletta Sarto. Why did you choose to make the protagonist become so basically deeply involved in what she was investigating?
Yeah, I was just really interested in the point that Nicoletta is at in her life. She's trying desperately to move away from her past, but she's at a major turning point. And I think it's something that Tana French's Dublin Murder Squad novels do so well, is the detective always gets personally involved or has a personal connection with the case. And I've thought that was a really interesting approach in terms of the high stakes for the novel, for the protagonist. And funnily enough, in the second book that I'm writing, it's not as personal to Nicoletta, because you can't have that many skeletons in one's closet, but her personal life does get in the way.
So, as I said, you have a truly twisty plot with lots of surprises. Can you give us a window into your process of crafting the plot points?
Yeah, I always start with the character and setting. And I walk a lot and I make copious notes on the notes app on my phone, kind of telling myself the story when something occurs to me. And then I go home and on my laptop, do a story arc, like draw out a story arc. And I'm a big fan of a lot of screenwriting books that have really helped me with plotting. So I try and, you know, do the three-act structure.
The what?
A three-act structure.
Three-act.
Yeah. And I recently read a book called Stealing Hollywood by Alexandra Solikoff. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And she follows the three-act structure, but she approaches planning a novel like a screenwriter and planning eight sequences and making it very as visual for yourself as possible, so that it feels like each sequence is working, doing its thing at a different point in the story.
Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I have an idea in my mind for what should happen within those eight sequences. And I write out, like just in a Word document, a very brief description, so that I have an idea of, and I, at the moment, I might know exactly what's going on in the middle, but I have an idea of the very clear idea of the beginning and end sequences, so that I have an idea of my end destination. Might not know exactly how I'll get there, but it's good to have an end point in sight, I think.
So did you know the end before you started, you know, really writing this book?
Yes, I did, yeah. I had an idea of the end sequence and thought that someone else was going to get killed. That's not a spoiler, I don't think. Yeah, I actually wrote the last scene pretty early on. So endings are very important to me, I think. I love, as a reader, I love a really satisfying ending.
And this one was. I like a satisfying ending too. And
thank you.
And this one was great. So I want to come back to Ireland in the real life, not fiction, and ask you, how have things changed in Ireland since abortion became legal?
They have changed enormously in the last, well, Ireland has changed as a society enormously in the last kind of 30 years. It's not as conservative a society as it was. People don't listen to the church as much as they did. The idea of a family and what that constitutes has changed in accordance with the times. We're not a monocultural society anymore. And there's been a lot of immigration to Ireland as a result of the economic boom of the late 90s to late 2000s. But I think the referendum around abortion in 2018 opened a conversation that needed to be had for a long time around pregnancy, miscarriage, unwanted pregnancies, just on around the whole reproductive spectrum. And I think we're more open about those issues now than we would have been before.
Is there any danger of a backlash, or what has happened like here in the US?
I don't think so at the moment. I haven't heard in a while that there have been protests at maternity hospitals or anything like that. Yeah, I don't think there has been a backlash.
And your protagonist, Nicoletta Sarto, we can tell by her name that it's not a traditional Irish name.
That's right, yeah.
Was there a reason that you made her, were her parents immigrants, is that right?
Yeah, so her parents, there's quite a, I suppose in the early to mid 20th century, there was a wave of immigration from a town called Casalatico near Rome to Ireland and also the UK. And I suppose Nicoletta's parents would have been part of that wave of immigrants. And most of them settled in Dublin and elsewhere in the country and started businesses in hospitality. And I made Nicoletta's parents shopkeepers. And I think the reason I did that was because I've always felt an affinity with the Italian language and culture. And when I read a book about Italian immigration to Ireland, and I just captured my imagination a little bit. I wanted Nicoletta to feel like an outsider a little bit.
Yeah. Now, you've told us already you're starting, or I don't know how long you're into it, but writing the sequel to this. Do you think you can be a journalist and a fiction writer at the same time?
No, I don't think so. I haven't done any journalism in about a year. I'm focusing on the fiction at the moment. So I know a few, like some broadcasters who manage to juggle both, but I'm not very good at multitasking. So I think I prefer to focus on the fiction at the moment.
Well, I think it's a treat for readers, at least on this side of the pond. Claire Coughlin, you are the author of the crime fiction novel, Where They Lie. It is absolutely terrific. I highly recommend it to my listeners. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thanks so much, Francesca. It was great to talk to you.
Claire Coughlin. Listen to or read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. In 2023, we spoke with Fintan O'Toole about his personal history of modern Ireland, We Don't Know Ourselves. Among the various topics we covered was, of course, the fiercely repressive history of the Catholic Church towards reproductive rights and sexuality. Here's a clip where O'Toole talks about how that repression finally crumbled.
In refusing to think about or talk about healthy sexuality, the church really just promoted the most unhealthy kind of sexuality that you can possibly have, and in the end destroyed itself. You know, so what happened with this stuff was that over time, the ability to control what people said about it, how people reacted, did diminish. And so as the society changes, as people get more educated, as they get better off, there is a kind of confrontation coming, I suppose, throughout the course of the narrative of the book, you know, where there will be hell to pay. The extraordinary thing maybe is just how long that took. You know, it really took until pretty much the end of the 20th century for this whole system of corruption to come crashing down.
Right, and even into the 21st. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist and critic Fintan O'Toole about his book, We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. You know, the flip that you talk about between the old and the new in terms of the attitudes towards sexuality is starkly revealed in two votes. The anti-abortion vote of the 1980s, which enshrined abortion as illegal in the Constitution, and the one that undid it in 2016. Remarkable that the same number of people who voted against abortion in the 1980s voted to undo that constitutional ban in 2016, many of them older people. And this was also, there was also the legalization of gay marriage. You have a wonderful, really beautiful way of explaining how this happened. What was that?
So really what happened was that this cognitive dissonance that we were talking about broke down. You know, everybody always knew that Irish women had abortions, right? Because they went to England where it was safe and legal. But the whole system was so riven with hypocrisy, you know, that the idea was not that you know, that this would be stopped. It was that the women would remain silent. That was what was most important. Don't talk about it. And women didn't. You know, I knew many, many, many women, friends and colleagues, and you know, and it really wasn't until I was in my 40s, I would say, that I had female friends whom I knew had had abortions. You know, so even people I would have known very well just didn't talk about it, didn't say it. So it was wrapped in silence. And the same thing really happened for, well, particularly for gay men. You know, the laws, the British laws under which Oscar Wilde was prosecuted in the 1890s were still on the statute books in Ireland in the 1990s. And of course, again, they were increasingly unenforced. You know, prosecutions were rare. But again, the point wasn't so much to prosecute people because that was becoming embarrassing. It was to shut them up, to make sure they didn't speak, to make sure that they were ashamed of themselves, that they were kept in this sort of mental space where the reality of their lives didn't have to be acknowledged. And with both of those things, I think this is what flipped, you know, that... It's I think, to do, Francesca, with the idea of intimacy. You know, an intimate society, when it's repressive, is a nightmare, right? Because everybody's watching you, you know, and it has that sort of element of surveillance, and then you have to hide things. But if you can keep the intimacy, and it just switches, it turns into something else, which is, well, actually, you know me. I'm your neighbor, I'm your friend, I'm your workmate, I'm your mother, your father, your siblings. And with both of those issues, really, that's what happened. You know, that maybe one of the nice things about our society is that it's still a storytelling society. And people started telling their own stories, particularly women and LGBTQ people did. And it worked. I mean, it sort of transformed everything.
That was Fintan O'Toole. His personal history of Ireland is We Don't Know Ourselves. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to the entire interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows. Plus, find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. And you can read interview transcripts at the Writer's Voice Substack. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.